Welcome to the lifestyle segment of Conscious Leaders. Leadership isn't just about what happens in the boardroom. It's about curiosity, understanding the way we live our lives. It's about how we take care of ourselves, how we manage our time, and how we create balance in our lives. This is the way we live, and it impacts the way we lead. So let's dive in and discover how we can make conscious lifestyle choices that's not only there to improve our lives, but also to enhance the way we show up as leaders. How is it going, conscious leaders? I am super excited. Today is going to be a fascinating conversation. So I have been very transparent about my journey, but you know, over the past few years, we've seen an incredible shift in the way we talk about neurodiversity. You know, the movement really took hold for me when I began to hear more about dyslexic thinking and what that means. And it's championed by people like Richard Branson and Princess Beatrice. And then I could relate so strongly to this, to the story and to what's happening within the dyslexic thinking movement. But then post-pandemic, there was this wave of conversations around ADHD that gave me the courage to seek out my own diagnosis. Coming from a background where my father was autistic and dyslexic, which perhaps with more traits we didn't fully understand, there was a lot of unspoken shame surrounding these conditions my father had. And for a long time, I thought it was safer not to know because I was afraid of what the world would perceive of me and who I am. But then a friend and a past guest on the show, Shannon McLachlan, introduced me to someone who would change my life, Carla Pretorius. So Carla, she is a neurodiversity specialist, a psychotherapist, and all-around advocate for neurodivergent people. Helped me to understand and to take the first step. With her guidance, I went to the Neurodiverse Center, where I was diagnosed with autism, ADHD, and dyslexia. It was a moment of shock, yet it brought a deep sense of understanding. Since then, I've been on a personal journey to come to terms with these parts of myself. I've been writing my book in the back end, trying to make sense of this journey and watching my journey unfold. But today, I'm thrilled to sit with Carla in a space where I feel truly safe to explore, ask questions, and dive into what neurodiversity really means. So if you ever wondered about neurodiversity or have your own questions, stay tuned because I'm sure that this is going to be a very insightful conversation and maybe opening up your mind to what this could mean for you. Carla, I'm so excited. You said yes! How are you?
Thank you so much for having me, Carmen. And that was such a lovely introduction just on your journey too. I think it's going to help a lot of people just the way that you communicate, like what you went through and just how you felt going through the journey. So I really appreciate that. We need more of you out there.
Thank you so much. Now, first of all, before we even get started, I've noticed that you are a PhD candidate now and you're doing a lot of work. And tell me what is going on and what is your thesis all about?
Sure. So I've been in the field of neurodiversity now for 20 years. It really is my life and my passion. I was also diagnosed with ADHD and anxiety in my 30s. So ultimately, my PhD is going to be focusing on that. Maybe it's a little bit selfish, but it really is my clientele and my passion. So my PhD dissertation is on enhancing confidence and managing anxiety within autistic women, neurodivergent women. And I do that through a 5-step program or process, which includes self-awareness, self-discovery, self-regulation, a lot of self-love and understanding, and then also self-advocacy. So that really is it in a nutshell. I wish it was a little bit as fast as I just stated it. I wish I can complete the PhD, but it's a little bit of a longer process.
But thank goodness you're doing the work that you're doing, because we all know that there's not been enough research that's been done on women, especially with autism. And that is something that's really, I mean, I have so many questions and I look forward in diving in with the questions that I have. I think the starting point for me is, and I just want to go back to when the diagnosis was done. It was in 2022. And I remember as I was going through the process of the diagnosis, the questions that was being asked and the self-reflection especially post every session. Like I think there were 6 or 8 sessions that I had to go through and really understanding. And the more we got closer to the end, I realized, oh gosh, this is autism. Like the questions, because there was too many yeses, that there was no way. And I'm trying to figure out where are we heading. And obviously there's a, you know, as I mentioned, as I opened, there's a lot of shame and with what we went through with my dad and with stereotyping. He was a you know, post-war baby. He was just born after the Second World War stopped. So you know, so there was all of these stigmas around that. And anyway, I digress. One of the big things was when the moment I found out it's not, I always knew I had ADHD, but when you start finding out how intensely you have it and you start finding out, okay, right, there's also autism involved. It's a shock to the system, especially when you don't really know what that means. And I remember the first question that came out of my mouth without even thinking was, what do I call myself now? Where, and I tried to reflect back to that moment. It's like, okay, how am I going to build an identity in this new community? Who am I? And I remember it being explained, like I had a big problem with Hans Asperger because of the eugenics, you know, the eugenics movement with the Nazis and how children with disabilities were euthanized, you know, for that program. So calling myself a person with Asperger's or the condition of Asperger's, I don't know the political term, was just not sitting right with me. And we were going through all of these different terms. And it was just such an overwhelming and confusing moment. What, if for all the people out there that has to still go on this journey and going on this journey and probably going to listen back to this, what advice would you give them in this pivotal big moment of just being diagnosed?
Yeah, I think that's a good question, because I feel like with all the information that we have out there, it's really easy to just ask ChatGPT or ask Google nowadays, or, you know, ChatGPT nowadays, what now? I'm seeing all of these traits in me. Am I autistic? What does that mean? And I would refrain from doing that. I would choose my sources very wisely. I would probably speak to autistic advocates, and rather follow those accounts online, because the stigma is still very much ripe. You know, I mentioned this to you earlier, but I'll just mention this again. I went to a psychiatrist this morning to just speak about ADHD in general, and one of his questions was to me was, but you weren't hyperactive when you were a kid. And I was like, yeah, but, you know, I'm hyperactive in my mind. That's, I've got ADD, previously known as. And for somebody that's a specialist in the field, they should be more versed in what it means to be ADHD without hyperactivity, or autistic without being high needs autistic, you know. So it might be that you're a different level of on the spectrum, but there are thousands of autisms out there. And I don't think, I know most therapists and most specialists are not aware of this. You know, they still diagnose according to either you're plastically autistic or, as they call it, high-functioning autistic, which I don't like that term, but that's not true. There's a spectrum of autisms out there, and we really need to come to terms with it's a way of feeling, it's a way of being, it's a way of just reacting in the world that's different, and it's more intense, emotionally charged. So to answer your question in a little bit of a shorter manner, I would say that don't trust everything that's out there. Know that most professionals out there probably don't even know and are updated with the latest evolution of the definition of autism. So I would say choose your sources wisely.
Yeah, I couldn't agree with you more. And I mean, I felt like I was completely in safe hands. And it's a very, you know, you have to have a moment to mourn, you know, and to mourn a version of yourself. And almost like the puzzle starts, you know, to fit. All of a sudden you realize, oh, you know, this thing that I'm doing over here. So I'll give you an example. As we were going through the diagnosis, when I was younger, I still remember... You know, when I almost felt like a naughty child, I used to self-soothe, and I used to scratch myself into blisters on my feet and on my hands. And I remember my mom was so confused. She didn't know what these blisters were. And she was like, what's going on? Why do I have these blisters? And I didn't want to say I scratched myself. So I kept quiet. And we went to the doctors and the doctors were trying to fix me. And I thought, okay, I can't self-soothe anymore because my mom's going to find out. So I stopped self-soothing and I forced myself in that process. And as we were going through diagnosis, it actually started back in my 50s again. I started doing it again where I scratch myself or I bite my nails or I do this thing with my hair where I twist it. And sometimes with the legs, you know, when you're very anxious and you move your legs around. And, you know, when I started thinking back on self-soothing and how we use self-soothing, that was a very insightful moment. But I mean, is everybody that uses these methodologies to self-soothe, is it all relevant to the spectrum? Or, you know, when do you have to take it seriously and to see it as a symptom?
I think it's a combination, right? So like you said, the stimming or the self-stimulatory behaviors, it happened with all kids at a certain age. So some of them, it happens at a year, like 2 year age, and or if, even if they're older. But if it continues within when you're older and also when you're using it to cope in situations, that's when it becomes part of the diagnosis. So it's a combination of symptoms or characteristics rather that you need to look out for. Usually what I find with my clients when they come to see me and if they're pre-diagnosis, it feels like it's a combination of things that are kind of hindering them to just feel more relaxed in a social setting or within even a relationship with their partners. It's always that kind of overthinking, overanalyzing, that kind of overwhelm that they feel emotionally in a social setting or, you know, just with one other person, which is also social, or in a work environment or just interaction with colleagues or something like that. So there's always something from the outside that's kind of hindering them to just be themselves. And, you mentioned women earlier, and we do so much masking that it doesn't seem like we're actually bothered by the social interaction or what is expected of us. So it's also like that's a big point to cover, is just the amount of masking that women do and the types of masking or camouflaging.
And I'd really like for us to go there. I think while we're still in the diagnosis process and how that all went down from my perspective, you know, the one thing that really was quite freaky for me is, okay, now that I know this, I've got ADHD, don't know what it really means, but now I go and I start paying attention to who I am and how I do things. Because now when you go through the diagnosis properly, you actually start now, oh, but this question was asked, this must be this, and you start connecting the dots. And I always knew, for example, when people talk to me, I always look up, or when I have to think about something, I always disconnect my eye contact with somebody. And also taking into consideration that my autism is predominantly in sensory process disorder, so my senses are extremely heightened. From the clothes that I wear, what I can wear, what makes me feel suffocated, to my senses and how I can pick things up. And I must tell you, it freaks me out when, especially now that I've got menopause, and I want us to touch on that as well, because menopause also heightens your neurodiversity symptoms. So for me, when somebody talks to me, I need to look up, I think, and then I would then make eye contact the moment I've figured it out and what I'm going to say and my processing. But I think it's being perceived from the other end, because I see people following my eyes around like this, trying for me to make contact. It's not something of dishonesty or the stereotype that's around it. It really has to do with, I've got so much Ferrari thoughts, neurons connecting and waltzing in my head. I just need to understand where they go in a file so I can have a conversation with you.
You actually said, I think it's Halliwell, Jed Ned Halliwell said that we've got Ferrari brains. He
Ferrari
actually calls
brains.
it an ADHD 2.0, that book, which is a great book to read. But what you did mention, Carmen, is the ADHD, and that's the combination of ADHD and autism, right? So, and you also mentioned one of the characteristics, which is sensory sensitivity. That could be part of both of those diagnoses. It doesn't necessarily need to be, but they did add it in the DSM. So there are sensory dysregulation within the DSM is the Diagnostical and Statistical Manual, where we find the disorders, right? The definitions of the disorders as psychologists. So that is part of the autistic spectrum disorder diagnosis, is having sensory dysregulation. And that could be seen in various ways. So you can be hypersensitive to certain sensory input, or hyposensitive, or a combination. So you could crave it, or you have an aversion towards it, or you have a combined type. So sometimes, like, an example could be, I love listening to my type of music really loudly, but I can't listen to my partner's, like, death metal, you know. I can't
exactly
listen to
it. Oh, yes, it's so true. We have arguments about that all the time. It's so true. And also, no, like, the mobile phone, right? When somebody listens to a TikTok video or something, I cannot stand that sound, because I can't understand where the sound is coming from. I need to see. It's a crazy thing. But you know, it's interesting what you're saying there. I think ADHD is something I don't really understand, because I don't know what part of my brain is active at the moment. Does it make sense? Like, hyperfocus, when? Is it autism or is it ADHD? Can you maybe just, if you take ADHD, because I hear that term going around quite a lot, if you can differentiate both of them and how they are different and how they are similar.
Yeah, so it's a difficult combined type, because sometimes they play against each other. So I feel like this is kind of just a general way of saying it, but I feel like autistic individuals and people with ADHD make great friends, and they can learn from one another really well, because autistic individuals are more structured. So they are kind of more black and white thinking in the old way. That's what we would say. But it really is just kind of a way that they love systems. They love to fix something and put it in the box, and now it's done. You know, like, my partner is autistic and he doesn't like gray areas. So if I tell him, oh, I don't really think that's what we're going to be doing, he's like, but are we going to do it or are we not going to do it? Like, just give me a yes or no. Whereas ADHDers love living in the gray area. So it's like, oh, maybe I'll come, maybe I won't, I don't know. I don't know how I'll feel then. So it's a lot more kind of wishy-washy. And if you've got a combined type, those two kind of ways of thinking are constantly fighting against each other. So you want structure, you want routine, but you hate a schedule. And it's a difficult thing. So just to kind of differentiate it from a DSM point of view, that with ADHD, you obviously get the inattentive type, and we see that more within women, where they're inattentive. So they lose kind of, they zone out. You see it as zoning out. And then you get the hyperactive type, where you become quite hyperactive, or a combined type. Now, with the inattentive type, that doesn't mean that you're not hyperactive in your brain. So you can still be quite actively thinking about a million things and just kind of sitting and watching reality TV, but you're still thinking about a million things. Whereas with hyperactive, physical hyperactivity, that is what we see more in our younger boys, and that's why men were also more diagnosed. So that's ADHD. And then autism, you get quite an atypical way of communicating. So with autistic individuals, oftentimes they can have like a little professor way of talking. So they'll speak in like English and, you know, whatever languages they know, because it's usually more than one. But in, you know, like quite a higher grade of communicating. So they use big words and they use like terms that I sometimes need to go and Google afterwards after my sessions. They're extremely hyper fixated on their interest, if they found their interest. So they absolutely love it, and they're kind of like experts in the fields. they, like I said, there's a bit of a rigid way of thinking because they're more systems oriented. But saying that again, like this is generalizing. There are thousands of autisms. You know, you get like the more artistic types that are that aren't that systematic. You get individuals that are really super creative. They can do their artwork for hours on end, but to sit down to have a meal is just too much for them, sensory-wise, and just like, you know, the perceived expectations that are placed on them. So it's difficult to kind of box individuals in. But I would say the two profiles are different in a sense that ADHDers need less structure because they get bored easily, but they, I shouldn't say need, I should say they want less structure, but they need it. Whereas autistic individuals should probably be a little bit more flexible with their need for structure. So the combination of them is great. That's why my partner and I make a great partnership.
It's like left brain and right brain, like all together. But I mean, like this is also, yeah, it is really fascinating. And I wonder how that connects with introversion and extroversion. Because if I just look, because it's having two different personalities almost, like there can be tasks that I need to do. I'm just my ADHD self and I'm loving what I'm doing. But then there's things that I really need to focus on and that I need to do. And then it's like, I don't need to see the world. I don't need to be around the world. And I actually go into my shell and I completely, some people wouldn't even believe this. At home, I'm a very quiet person. I'm in my head. And, you know, I wonder what your view would be from a neurodiversity perspective on what we perceive as extroversion and introversion.
I think ADHD has come across as extroverts because we talk so much and we love talking. And but the reason for talking so much is not always because we want to be the center of attention. We dislike moments of quiet or, you know, those awkward silences. So we just want to fill it, and we've got an inhibition problem, right? So if I hear nobody is talking and I can see, because I'm highly empathic, and most neurodivergent people are highly empathic because we feel other people's emotion. I just want to fill that gap because I don't want somebody else to feel awkward. So it's not like I'm an extrovert. I wouldn't say I am, but I definitely come across as one. So I would probably say that ADHDers come across as extroverts more, and you know, previously known as people with Asperger's syndrome or less needed support individuals or autistic individuals, they come across as more introverts. But I don't think it is actually, it's not that simple. I think there's a lot more to it.
But I'm loving this conversation because, you know what, it's so true. Like, it's like, oh my gosh. But I mean, another thing that I've noticed, and you know what, I'm just talking to you like as I'm trying to remember moments that really stood out for me, was, you know, when I started having the conversation with family and like, this is what I've been diagnosed with, and you know, this is what I'm going through, I just think I should tell you, the denial, like, oh my gosh, it can't be, not you. But like the ADHD, I'm sure everybody knows, when you just watch me close by and you start looking at the symptoms. But the autism, I think, came as a shock. And I think it was in that moment, because there's a perception of what autism looks like. And you know, the response that really triggered me was the response, and that's how I always used to go and think about my father, and like, I wonder if he ever experienced this these moments, was, oh, shame, I'm so sorry to hear that. That response triggers me so much because I just think that it's an awful way of it's almost showing sympathy, not empathy. I don't know. There's something so wrong about that response. For family members that maybe will be, what is the atypical, or what would the word be, neurotypical?
Neurodivergent?
Who are not neurodivergent. Isn't it neurotypical?
Neurotypical, yes.
Neurotypical. So for your neurotypicals and people that don't have any conditions, you know, when they hear this or their family members going through it or they're in a social situation, what is the best response to give?
Such a great question, and one that I actually get quite often during presentations, because the response that you got is a response that's quite typical, which is it's so patronizing to hear that. I mean, just a little bit of a backstory before I answer this. I'm currently, like you said, busy with my PhD, right? And these professors are great that I see in my class, but still, when I introduce myself and I say, look, I've got ADHD, I definitely have PDA, which is pathological demand avoidance, which is an awful term.
Sounds hectic.
That sounds awful. I know, but it's not even in the DSM, right? So a better way of saying it is a persistent drive for autonomy. So basically, I just want to be in control of my own choices because I feel so out of control in my head, which is something that we definitely need to discuss one day more. But anyways, I introduce myself like this. My professors, who are professors in psychology, will still have this reaction of like, no, you're not. Like, and I'm there trying to defend my diagnosis to people that should be a lot more open, right? So it really is infuriating. That's the first point that I would say. Secondly, if you're trying to like think about this from psychology professors to your family members who probably have less experience in psychology than the professors, right? It's going to be probably even harder to help them understand. So what I would suggest, and this has worked wonders in my own life, is just to open up about your symptoms more. Like when I go out and something's overstimulating, I always put my noise cancelling headphones on, or I put like loop earplugs in or something, and immediately I tell the people that I'm around, look, this is just overwhelming for me. The baby is shouting, the dog's barking, three people are talking to me, and it's sensory wise, it's too much for me. So I don't say to them, look, I've got ADHD and sensory sensitivities and this is why, because then they're like, oh well, diagnoses.
Yeah.
But I just explain to them what is going through my brain. I started doing it with my partner because, you know, we don't trust easily. It's another thing that we have because we can see when people lie. Mm-hmm. So I only started doing this recently.
Sorry, I need a moment. And then you have to pretend it's not happening.
Yes, yeah. Exactly. And it's like the smallest thing that really get us. And it's just because you can't trust people. Because like you can see through that lie. And now how are you supposed to trust whatever else they're going to say? You know, we're really focused on the details. And I can't move on. If somebody is told a blatant lie, I have to take them on. I have to stop them before I move on with this relationship. I wish more people were like this. But my neurodivergent friends are. So that's great. But anyways, I don't know.
So you're saying getting more neurodivergent friends is important.
But the other thing I wanted to mention just before we move on from this is you said neurotypical versus neurodivergent, right? And, you know, like maybe a couple of years ago, I would have agreed with that. But I now believe that more people, and this is what research is also saying, that more and more people are showing signs of having characteristics of being neurodivergent. And I don't believe that every person is neurodivergent, but I do believe that every person is more, has an affinity towards a specific profile, right? So it could be a neurodivergent profile, or it could be a bipolar profile, or it could be more of an anxious, more of a depressed, more of a whatever. So I don't see like one person being normal. I don't think there is such a thing.
I love that because a lot of people think that, but they don't know how to say it because it's so political, right? Especially this world of neurodiversity. You have to be so careful in how you express and say those things. But I have read studies on this, and I don't know what your opinion is, for example, digital dyslexia, where technology is starting to play a very big role in some of our neurodiversity conditions. It was actually a few years ago that I read up on that. And the other thing is when I went for my menopause things to a doctor to check my microbiomes, She explained to me the importance of your gut health and how the gut health actually has a massive impact on neurodiversity. And if you look at all the food and all the crap that's out there and what we're eating and whatever hormones they've put in it to make it grow faster and quicker, you know, we got to start asking deeper questions about like the foods that we eat and the impact that this is having on our mental health. So what is your view on that?
So I'm so happy you brought up this topic. This is one thing that I want to kind of specialize in, not really the biology part of things, but the physiological representation of the, this is going to sound like a mouthful, but it's the physiological representation of the amount that we suppress our needs and how that shows up in our body. And that gut-brain link that or connection that you were talking about is one thing. Another thing is we're constantly suppressing what we're feeling. So if it is overwhelming in an environment or if somebody does lie to us or whatever, we suppress, suppress, suppress. And that comes out in our physical health. You know, like I have so many of my clients are showing have chronic illnesses. And it just came out of nowhere, apparently. And it really is just years and years. You can see this with their prognosis. It's years and years of not speaking up and not advocating for themselves. And it becomes anxiety that leads into dread, that leads into chronic illnesses. So I definitely think it's a combination of what we eat and how much we listen to our bodies and listen to what is bothering us and actually making a change. So, yeah, I'm all for it. I mean, when I was younger, I wasn't worried about what I ate and how much I drank. But now I'm definitely a bit more worried.
Yeah, and you know, one should be. And I think, like, I've also been going on this journey and trying to see what works for me and what's not working and taking things out of my diet, then reintroducing things. You know, what's working and how does my brain feel? So I'm not medicated at all, right? There's days where I think I should be. I perhaps, you know, I don't even know who to consult with when that stage comes. But I think from my perspective is I'm trying to do it as holistic as possible. I'm trying to do it through food and trying to be more conscious of what I'm eating and my meditation and doing things that makes me feel good. Some days it's very hard. And I mean, I can be honest in this conversation, but you know, I took a few days out of my schedule just to relax for a bit. And it was the first time this year. I work from Monday to Sunday. I'm an entrepreneur and I don't switch off because my brain can't switch off. And I would go to bed and now with menopause on top of that, you know, toss and turn for 2 or 3 hours before I fall asleep. And then I always wake up tired. And so I started on the journey of fixing my menopause and really working on that. And it's really made a big difference for me. But at the same time, there's that part of what's going on in my brain. And I think that so many people, you know, discard that and don't think about, you know, how it impacts their day-to-day life and how it shows up in your body. But I can get panic attacks or sometimes, you know, when it gets too overwhelming, dark thoughts into my mind. And I think that, you know, as we are talking about Mental Health Awareness Month, I mean, this is a month to really reflect on neurodiversity and that impact of on our mental health.
Mm. Yeah, and thank you for sharing that, Carmen. I know it's difficult to talk about our own mental health sometimes, especially on social platforms. But I think it does help others to see that there are a lot of people, if not everyone, that go through all of this, and we need to speak up more. And we definitely need to take care of ourselves. I know that you're saying that you're an entrepreneur, and that's amazing. We have this in our minds, though, that we can't switch off. And I know that it feels like that, but I would say to challenge that and to maybe kind of channel it into something so that you can, you don't have to switch off like a typical person would say is a switch off, like not think about anything. I mean, that to me is impossible. But when you're doing a meditation, maybe do like an immersive meditation where you hold your phone and it takes you on a journey and it will like start shaking. And that's my way of meditating because it keeps me entertained.
How do you do that?
There's an app. They actually give you like a year for free. It's called Balance, and they have immersive meditation. So I'm sure there are other apps out there as well that have that. But that's how I got into meditation, because if you told me you need to listen to a gong for 20 minutes, I'd be like, no thanks, that's never gonna happen. But there are other ways, right? So whatever your interest is, so let's say it's walking next to the ocean, like try and do like a mindful walk where you see how many things you can feel with your feet, or how many greens can you see, or something, just to still stimulate your very active brain, but focusing on something that's calming. Because what we tend to do as ADHDers, and this is your ADHD part for sure, is we go with that overstimulating, because it's like acute slang, we're dopamining. So we just want more of it. So we want to get more research articles, read more books on the topic. We just want to write books. We want to create new things, and that leads to autistic burnout, which I definitely don't want for you. So that's something that I would say is like to challenge that I can't switch off part. I would have never said that I was able to chill a few years ago, but I feel like Mr. Miyagi now, I can chill. I can relax.
Oh my gosh. But I mean, it's listening to what you're saying, and it's fascinating to me, because I'm trying to also understand how this plays off in corporate, right? Or in your work environment, because work environments have become very toxic. And if I think about a few of my neurodivergent friends, I find it very, very challenging to switch off, because the demands on their careers are so much ROI, ROI, when's the next thing, where's the next thing? It's almost like businesses have ADHD. They dopamining as well. And the expectations and the requirements that's put on people, and especially if we're now booming and where we're seeing a lot more diagnosis coming through, I wonder, like, what do businesses need to start thinking about in terms of, dealing with a workforce that is neurodivergent?
Definitely getting more training into what does that mean for them, and how to interact more successfully with neurodivergent individuals, because they're taking advantage of our interest, our hyperfixation. And what I usually tell my clients that are neurodivergent, that are close to becoming burnt out, is to pull back 20%, because your 100% as a neurodivergent individual is already way too much. So you should be giving a lot less than what you think you should be giving. Like if you think about a typical individual going to work, they're going to be on their phones, they're going to be taking tea breaks, they're going to be, calling their partners or friends and so on. And a neurodivergent friend person is usually like, no, I have to work. I'm here to work. These are my tasks. We don't really often take time off, so we have to keep that in consideration. That's fine, but then work less, fewer hours. We have to start pulling back, because otherwise we just go from boom to bust the whole time.
Yeah, so true. So I want us to start diving into the unmasking of autism, especially for women, and what that looks like, because let's talk about the research. I think one of the biggest shocks for me was learning about how there's not enough research on women, and how I can just think of many women in my family, and probably women that are friends of mine, that I don't have the guts to say, listen, you got symptoms, you got to go and see somebody and just find out, because you can't have those conversations. That person needs to have the self-awareness to embark on that journey. However, it's a very liberating journey. But what I wanted to say is, like, what are these typical symptoms, and when do you need to go for a diagnosis? And just give us context as to, the unjust, and I'm going to call it the unjust, that was done, and how research was done only on boys, or what is the whole research story behind women with autism?
So I think it's unjust now, but in those days, obviously the professionals back then, I don't want to give them credit, but they didn't know. So you can't really focus on a population that you didn't see. So they just didn't know because, like you said, women are way better in masking and camouflaging. So those two, from an evolutionary point of view, we were told to be the social butterflies, and the hunter-gatherer. If you look at that evolution, then the men were out there on their own hunting, and we were gathering. So we were taught from centuries ago to be social. So we're really good in faking it, and camouflaging as social beings. So that's the first thing that I would say to look out for if you're looking for a female or a woman diagnosis, is that somebody that probably looks fine. Like, I'm talking to the autistic individuals now, or potentially autistic individuals. You probably look and you look fine, not fine. You look social. You look like you don't have a care in the world when you are interacting with friends and colleagues and so on. But inside, you feel really anxious when you're doing these things. You're overthinking, you're overanalyzing. After the conversation, you think, oh, I should have said this, I could have said this. Maybe like 3 years later, you're still thinking about a specific scenario that you shouldn't have messaged that person. Maybe this relationship could have worked if I just did this and this and that. So it's like this overanalyzing of past events, future events, current events. It's really draining. That's the first thing. You mentioned the sensory sensitivities, which is also another point, is that we're definitely heightened, even more so than men, from a sensory point of view. So if you have an extreme reaction to temperature changes, to anxiety even, so I don't know if you can see this, but my neck is really red, and it's because I'm anxious when I go into a presentation or a talk like this. And I'm okay with this now. When I was younger, I was like covering myself up with makeup, camouflaging. I didn't want to look like I'm different. Now I'm just like, oh, whatever, I'm nervous, I'm anxious, that's me.
Love
Yeah. And then also like the special interest. So if you have a special interest that you feel like you can do for hours on end, and you can even forget to eat, forget to go to the toilet because you're now busy with, your research in the different cultures or the different history or whatever, that's my partner's interest. Emotionally, the feeling of overwhelm, that's another one especially for women, autistic women. That moment where one thing can tip you over and you can just be completely like felt, it feels like you were hit by a wave of emotions and you feel like you're frozen. So your central nervous system is kind of in survival mode, where you can't move. So you go into shutdown or meltdown mode. That's another one of those telltale signs that you might be neurodivergent. And then also just the difficulties with social interaction. So just having that where, I mentioned this before, but when you're going into a social circle, you feel like a sense of expectations on you. And it might not be that anyone has told you anything, but you feel like you have to interact. It's like that perceived expectation. So that's autism in women that I would say is different than in men.
Fascinating. And there's so many of these symptoms, and I think it's not looking at them in isolation, but looking at them in a combination. So, okay, right, but if I have a lot of these symptoms, maybe just do it. I personally feel that everybody should just go for a test and just go for the whole process. I've seen even influencers on ADHD that have been taking over the world with it, and they're so informative. Only realized the other day that they might have autism as well, and now they have to start all over again. And just go and get it done and check out the full Monty and just make sure you do it correctly. I don't necessarily agree with doing the online tests. I think it's a better idea to do it with somebody in consultation, because when you don't understand the questions and how they are posed or what those things specifically mean, you might interpret it incorrectly and answer the question incorrectly.
Yeah, I agree. I think also being with somebody makes it a little bit easier for you to navigate the journey further. So even if it's not going through the full assessment, because it could be expensive, right? Like a lot of people, either in the UK, I work with a lot of UK clients where they have to wait 3 years for the assessment through the NHS because there's such a backlog. So sure. Either that or it is expensive. So there's a waiting list. Or going private is perhaps too expensive. Maybe you have a therapist that you can just speak to. Make sure that they know about neurodiversity. Make sure that they've studied further and that they're a little bit more modern in their way of thinking, I would say, is important. Because like I said, this morning the psychiatrist was lovely, but his questions to me were very much old school, like, but you're just saying that you're not very, you're saying a lot of times you're anxious. And I was like, yeah, I'm anxious because there are so many expectations on me socially. And he's like, yeah, but you got good grades and you listened in class and you weren't hyperactive. And I'm like, yeah, okay. I'm not going to try and convince you. Stereotyping. Yeah, exactly.
but this is, yeah, this is the reality. And also, I think, you know, also just looking back on my journey, like I don't even feel that it's unfolded for me properly yet. And I haven't made sense of it. And I really have to take it one step at a time. And every time when there's something, you know, that's where I'll go to ChatGPT and I'll say, okay, right, I'm experiencing the symptom. Is this now part of this thing or that thing? And I really enjoy also going onto YouTube. There's a lot of fascinating videos, but I think it's neurodiversity center or something like that. I've seen some of their videos, but yeah, I think it's important, you know, to unpack this conversation. And I think that there's a lot more for us to do, and building the self awareness, talking about workplace inclusivity, things that needs to get done, the nuances and so forth. But I mean, I want to also end up on a little bit of a high with this, because knowing that it's also my superpower is also amazing for me. Like, I think every time when I do have those tough days and it's really hard for me, and I just like literally want to pull my hair out of my head because the thoughts don't want to stop. There's also moments where I go, oh, can the ideas just keep on flowing? Because I'm like a salt and pepper, like, you know, you just shake me and it's ideas that comes out of me. I get to express my creativity and I get to live it. And I think that, you know, a lot of people mourn this. It's just learning how your brain works and how you need to navigate through that. And I mean, I'm not an expert, but for me personally, there's good days, there's crappy days, and then there's bad days. But, you know, it's finding that balance and so, okay, right, this is what I've got to work with. But focusing on the good outcomes that comes from it is something that I always celebrate with myself. And I go, oh, my gosh, Carmen, I'm so freaking proud of you. And I have the self-talk moments, because I think if I don't have them, I will really have a bad opinion about myself.
I think it's lovely what you just said, Carmen. I think we need to, first of all, you are the expert because it's your body. You're the only person True. That knows what thoughts are going through your brain and how you're reacting to it. So you are the expert. Every person out there listening is they're the expert of their own neurodivergence or brain, right? But secondly, I would say that, yes, it is great. None of my clients has ever said that they want to take their autism or ADHD out. They said that sometimes they, yes, it is overwhelming, but they want to be autistic. They want to have ADHD. It is about learning how your brain works and how you can better support your brain and not living according to typical expectations. That's really important. So if you feel like, oh, I have to have a lot of friends, I should have a lot of friends, I should go to this party, I would say pause there and just challenge that. Because do you really want to go to the party? Do you really need that many friends? I mean, I have such limited amount of friends, and I chose that. I literally did an audit on my friends, sorry friends, and I said, look, who's actually giving me any energy here and who's just sapping it? And I needed to do that because I don't need five friends even. I just need a couple of good friends and that's it. And one of them is my partner. So basically I have two friends.
We're in the same boat. Look, listen. And I think it's so refreshing to hear that because like I when I'm out there, I'm a socialite and I give what I have to give and I want to give. But then when I'm home, I'm home. And my home is my home and my family is my family. And I do have friends, but it's maybe seeing you once every 3 months, having a coffee or a lunch. It's not like let's braai over the weekends. I'm a very like, and some people don't understand that, but it really is we need to gain our energy, especially from an over-processing perspective. And when you have so much going on, like, you know, I have to tell you, I tell everybody about the story. I'm going to tell you quickly, right? How freaky is this? You know that experiment thing that was going around with an apple? You take half an apple, put it in a jar, speak positive to it. Okay, so let me quickly explain it. So you take two jars, you take an apple, cut it in half, and you put half an apple in the one glass jar and half an apple in the other one. On the one jar, you write positive thoughts and positive words and affirmations to say you're going to grow to your full potential, blah, 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 blah. Negative one, do the same thing. I did the experiment, and within the third day, there was a little plant growing out of the apple with the jar closed, growing out from the positive affirmations. You must try this. It's really awesome. Okay. The negative ones, the same, not the same thing. The opposite happened. The jar actually started sweating. Sorry. Listen. Let me just calm down. The words were, see, I can't talk fast and think fast. One thing has to be slow, right? Something,
there's
okay.
There's no rush. There's no rush.
And the negative one, I was like, okay, let me have negative conversations with it. And I started seeing the third day. It was like all misty and it was looking terrible and it was starting to get all this gug and it was disgusting. Anyway, the seventh day, I was angry about a situation. I think it was the seventh day. I can never remember. But anyway, I was so angry about a situation. And I thought, I don't want the whole world to know what's going on in my mind and what I'm upset. I'm just going to go to the jar since we are doing the experiment. I took the jar and I just released all the thoughts going on in my head, right? And I released it. I then decided I'm going to go for a walk. Came back 30 minutes later and the jar went, it popped. The lid popped.
Oh, jeez.
And then
you
it popped.
You should have had a camera in there. That would have been
I did film. I did. But listen, it was the events and everything that happened. But I did film it. Had witnesses. It was like a whole thing. And because it was an experiment we were doing and I wanted to actually share it on social media. Hence, I filmed it and all of that kind of stuff. But I think the thing that really stood out for me, and I actually learned this from Sarah McLachlan because she said, do this experiment. Okay. And it was so profound for me because I realized, oh my gosh, if I'm so heightened and my senses are so heightened and it could happen to these jars, how do I perceive other people's energy? Because I can't see it. I can only feel it. How is that impacting my health as a human being?
Exactly.
It's not just the thoughts in my head, but that experiment was such a big awakening for me. And literally I mean I'm also a sensitive and I don't understand, but somehow being a sensitive is different to neurodiversity. So I'm still trying to understand how that all works. But for me is I can almost see premonitions of things happening before they happen, or like patterns or all those kind of things. So that is an extra layer for me, which makes it sometimes very hard for me to read the room, if that makes sense, because what I'm seeing is not what you're telling me, and it's not what I'm seeing. And for other people to get onto that boat takes a longer time. But it's very fascinating to be on this journey, and I'm loving the science that is coming out and the extra, you know, advocates and people like yourself that's just doing the work and getting the word out there. And, you know, I love your videos on LinkedIn. I love every single thing that you're putting out because it's a journey of learning for me as well. Like, you know, I have a spicy brain and I love it. I'm actually going to make a t-shirt for that.
That's awesome.
But yeah, but thank you so much.
Yeah, just that last thing that you said, Carmen, about like just having all of those emotions. That's also why neurodivergent individuals make such good therapists, because we're able to see what's actually going on. It's just the tricky part there is to learn how to also have boundaries and to install those boundaries. So even if you're not a therapist, it doesn't matter. You're still, all of that emotions, those emotions are seeping into you. So I would say it's very important for you who are highly empathic to make sure that you have a way to kind of switch that off. So for me personally, how that is once I'm finished with a client, I would take their notes and then I would put it in the box where their, you know, where their other notes are, and I would close the box. So that's like a visual for me to say, okay, you know what? Now I'm finished thinking about this person, because otherwise it's going to replay my mind. I have to do something visual because I'm visually inclined. But yeah, it might be a way for you to just like put it off. Anyways, we can speak for hours, so I will let you go. Thank you so much.
But we will definitely do this again because I think there's a lot more. And let's see what questions come from the community and see what conscious leaders have to say. And then maybe we can take it then and bring you in again, because you know there's not enough being said, and I love the work that you're doing, and thank you for being part of my journey. And you know, if it wasn't for you, I probably wouldn't be at the state of awareness I'm at now. So thank you.
Thanks, Carmen. That means a lot. Thank you for having me. It's
thank
been a
you.
Lot of fun.
Bye-bye now.
You've been listening to another production from Solid Gold Podcasts.